Hi, my name is Megan.
And I'm Omer.
And you're listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast.
Megan, this is the first time you're serving as a co-host of the podcast, right?
Yes, it is.
So, of course, as the producer of the podcast, you've always had a crucial role in its creation. But maybe we should tell the listeners a little bit about you.
Sure. I started working on the podcast as an intern, and now I am Gen Squeeze's communications lead.
Wow, quite the upgrade. All right. Well, in this episode of the podcast, we will be chatting with Dave Sawyer. Dave is an environmental economist who has held positions with Environment Canada, as well as with the Commissioner of Environment and Sustainable Development.
And he's currently a school fellow at Carleton University School of Public Policies and an executive in residence with the Smart Prosperity Institute at the University of Ottawa. And we must say that Dave also heavily contributes to Gen Squeeze's climate crisis work.
You know, especially in the past few years, it seems like many of the people who've come to know of us see us mainly as an organization that focuses on housing issues. But of course, housing is just one of the issues we work on.
Absolutely. Our real interest is in promoting generational fairness. And the climate crisis is one of the greatest intergenerational injustices of our time, because it will largely be our generation's kids and grandkids that have to deal with its impacts.
In the interview you're about to hear, we chat with Dave about Gen Squeeze's climate solutions framework and the platform analysis work that we do. We also have a wide-ranging discussion about pricing carbon.
So we talked with Dave on Tuesday, July 19th. We began asking him about the federal government's proposals to set up a new cap and trade system that would help regulate emissions from the oil and gas sector.
Before jumping into the interview, we do want to say Gen Squeeze is a nonpartisan organization. We seek to work with people, parties, and policymakers from across the political divide.
So while our guests will air a range of perspectives on this podcast, we want to be clear that Gen Squeeze does not necessarily endorse their views, and we'll continue to invite people from across different spectrums to join our conversations.
All right, that all sounds good. Let's get to the interview.
In the news this week, the federal environment minister, Stephen Guilbeault, just unveiled a proposal to set up a new cap and trade system targeting the oil and gas sector. And the goal is to lower emissions from the oil and gas sector 40% by 2030. I wonder if you could help us understand how this new system's going to work and how is it different than what we currently have in Canada?
Yeah, so, I mean, in Canada, greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, our emission reduction aspirations have always been a function of rising oil and gas emissions. So the oil and gas sector in Canada takes up a large chunk of our total emission inventory. Typically, most other sectors, buildings, other industry, transportation, emissions have been rising or falling or been stable. And a lot of our emissions growth can be tied to the oil and gas sector. So therefore, any emission success around targets around 2030 or net zero beyond really need to factor in oil and gas emissions, which account for almost a third of our total emissions. So what did Minister Guilbeault do this week? So a discussion paper was put out that basically responded to some campaign promises that I did work with Gen Squeeze to look at the Liberal platform in the last two federal elections, and including the last federal election, where the government started rolling out, or the Liberal Party started rolling out some proposals. And one of those proposals was an oil and gas cap. And that is basically to put a limit on the emissions coming from the oil and gas sector on a trajectory between now and 2030 that gets us emission reductions consistent with the national target. So the discussion paper this week proposes two big options. So Megan, as you said, one option is a new cap and trade system. So what's a cap and trade system? So Quebec has a cap and trade system right now. They've had one since 2013. And basically that sets an absolute limit on the emissions that the province will allow. And that then target is allocated down to sectors ultimately, so to the manufacturing sector, and to emitters ultimately, in the form of allowable units to pollute. And basically what happens is you shrink, you create scarcity, you shrink the number of permits, that then drives up prices, which then values pollution, and then you allow people to buy and sell and come up with bargains basically to, you know, one person can reduce a lot of emissions at a certain cost, someone else has a higher cost, so maybe they'll enter into a bargain and buy those emission reductions. So that's one of the proposals on the table, is to cap emissions. The other proposal on the table in that discussion paper is to look at the current Alberta carbon pricing system, which is enabled under the federal backstop system, meaning it's equivalent and the federal government approves it. And I can explore that in a second. But basically in that current system, they have a way, it's called a ratcheting factor, but they basically have a way that they're going to tighten down the limit on emissions. And they're basically going to say to the oil and gas sector, okay, we're going to use the existing system. We're going to require that on a year-over-year basis, you have to reduce more emissions or your compliance obligation, the tons that you're allowed to emit gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And that'll drive up prices and that'll basically drive a bunch of technology deployment. So yeah, those are the two big sort of systems on the table.
And what do you think of them? Do you lean towards one over the other?
Yeah, there are trade-offs. The big trade-off right now is we have an existing system that the oil and gas sector is living within. And that system is nestled in a broader large emitter program that has in Alberta anyway, and well, coast to coast in every single jurisdiction, there are large emitter programs. It's one type of carbon pricing in the country focused on the really big industrial emitters. And one of the challenges is that you have that system already operating where the oil and gas sector is integrated and trading with other large emitters. And if you carve out a new system, you're basically limiting the ability to get gains from trade. So there's a large sector there, and if you sort of put a ring fence around them and create an island, it doesn't allow for really cost-effective solutions where they could perhaps sell into the other large emitting programs or or buy. So there's inefficiency problems with basically carving out a new system, and you know, the oil and gas sector is so important to that market and to the sort of allowing for efficient emission reductions and trades to happen, that a whole new system carved out might lead to some problems. And then the beauty of using the current system is that you can just literally get it done overnight. You can basically set a new regulatory limit in existing federal and ultimately Alberta regulations. And that then sets the new standard for the facilities. And we can't underestimate how complex these systems are. I was involved in designing and working with Ontario on their cap and trade program. And we had a PowerPoint presentation of 122 pages. And each page had a very detailed description on a single design element that had to be discussed and basically worked out. And of course, those design elements, you can look to other jurisdictions like Quebec right now to get the idea about what to do there. But you can't underestimate the administrative complexity and then the timing to get this thing implemented. So I think that and the new administrative structure to do this system. So I think, you know, cap and trade, very supportive of it in Ontario, very supportive of it right now in Nova Scotia and Quebec. But really, transitioning the current system to that is fraught with some challenges.
Could you explain more about how the provinces and the federal government, what is the dynamic there of reducing emissions and mitigating climate change?
Yeah, right. So on the emissions side, the federal government and the provincial governments have shared jurisdiction over energy and emissions. So the federal government can act independently and the provinces can act independently. And so what we've had historically is we've had a federal government that was lagging effort before the Trudeau government came in 2015 in the Paris era around more climate ambition. Before then, we had a really sort of stuttering federal government on taking action and an unwillingness to implement big, broad policies to cover emissions and drive down emissions ultimately. And And so what you had emerging because of the shared jurisdiction is you had various provinces leading and various provinces lagging. So leading provinces would include in 2007, British Columbia, 2008, British Columbia's carbon tax, which is still in existence today. It's a model for, you know, basically the world. Lots of people have always been interested in the BC carbon tax. We have large industrial pricing in Alberta in 2007, which was actually the first major carbon pricing program in the country. That's right, oil and gas has been under carbon pricing since 2007. So that's 15 years of carbon pricing in the oil and gas sector. Whether or not we got significant reductions out of it, that's a design issue. But you know, that industrial, that program is now being used coast to coast now, and it's the basis of the federal large emitter program. And yeah, and it's being adopted elsewhere. And then Quebec in 2013, cap and trade was implemented in cooperation with California under the Western Climate Initiative. So linked trade between the jurisdictions. The Ford government then killed cap and trade in Ontario. And then now we have the federal government where basically we have 80% of our emissions covered by carbon pricing with the new federal carbon pricing backstop, requiring the provinces to meet a standard. If they meet a standard, they can have their own program. So yeah, that's basically the long twisted history.
Yeah, well, and I wonder if you could clarify, just in case any of our listeners aren't familiar with some of those terms, like what is the layman's version of carbon pricing versus cap and trade? What are the differences between those systems?
Yeah, so I mean, the way to think about this is one is limiting quantities and one is quantities of emissions. That's cap and trade. So we're going to limit emissions. We're going to create scarcity by basically setting the limit on total allowable emissions below what you're going to do otherwise. So if I'm emitting 10 emissions, 10 units, we're going to set your cap at 8 emissions. You've got to reduce or buy 2 emissions from somebody. And so that's cap and trade. And basically you create a market for pollution allowances to be sold and to be held and then used in compliance to hit your sort of individual target. So that overall cap is allocated right down to the facility level. And it ends up in the consumer's hands as a price increase. It looks exactly like the carbon tax because the fuel distributors have to hold the allowances, the permits, which they have to buy, and then they pass on the price. And so that's how we see it. So from a consumer perspective, they're identical systems in terms of the signal we see when we're standing at the pump, if we don't have an EV, or if we have an EV and depending on the emission intensity of the electricity, we see the same price, roughly. And then carbon pricing is really simple. We basically figure out how many units of pollution are in a liter of gasoline or a liter of fossil fuels, and we set a rate on that. And then prices rise and people respond accordingly.
I just want to go back a bit on the jurisdictional question, because it can be quite messy, right? And so in response to this latest proposal or set of proposals, we've gotten a joint statement from the Alberta Ministers of Energy and Environment. And maybe I'll quote that and get your response, Dave. They say, Alberta will not accept any plan from the federal government that seeks to interfere in our constitutionally protected ability to develop our resources. Provinces are the owners of these natural resources, which have been responsibly managed on behalf of Canadians for decades.
Yeah, so, I mean, this issue is settled by the Supreme Court. So the right-leaning political governments sitting in Ontario, Manitoba, Alberta, and Saskatchewan took the federal government to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, in fact, the federal government can, under certain conditions, can price pollution, can price carbon in the country. So that's an interesting statement coming out of Alberta. I mean, when you talk about a cap on the oil and gas sector, a lot of people read that as, and the politicians can twist that as, a cap on production. Now, if the federal government chose to cap the level of barrels that could be produced or cubic meters of natural gas, the Supreme Court would say, no, you don't have jurisdiction over the quantity of production, but you do have jurisdiction over emissions. So it basically the decisions were upheld. And so the federal government, you know, has the latitude to move here. But politics gets messy, so that legally they can do it, but politics gets messy because suddenly you have a federal government getting really aggressive on one sector in the economy, one set of large emitters, albeit a very important one, and frankly a fairly wealthy one as a rule, with lots of technological know-how to basically reduce emissions. Incredibly smart group of people to solve this sort of problem. And so politically, it is just a big old fight. And that will continue, and there will be messaging. But ultimately, the federal government has the levers to basically do it. And then if the provinces don't like the form of that, they can take them to court again, which maybe they will.
And we've talked a lot about how this targets the oil and gas sector, which I think, did you say that was about a third of the total emissions? What's the status of the other big emitters and those other sectors that also need to cut back on emissions?
Yeah, so the first way to think about this is sort of 80% of our national emissions, just under 80%, are now covered by carbon pricing. The 20% that are not covered are typically never covered by these programs. So they're typically like land use emissions, you know, forestry emissions. And so typically these emissions are, you know, so you think about Manitoba, you know, half of their emissions come, roughly half, come from land use emissions and half come from energy. So their coverage of the emissions with carbon pricing looks really low. Oh, it's only 50%, 56% of their emissions. But in fact, they're covering all their energy emissions. So coast to coast, we have all of our energy emissions covered. And so that's a good thing. And then that includes other large emitters sitting in basically they're called output-based pricing systems. And it's a little different than the carbon tax system, and it's a little more complex. But basically, there's special allocations made for competitiveness reasons. So these are typically the emission-intensive and trade-exposed facilities. You use sectoral economic and emission data against some tests to identify whether or not they meet thresholds around being really emission intensive and trade exposed. And the idea is because you have misaligned carbon pricing, so we have carbon pricing in Canada and not the US, we do most of our trade in the US. If we're disadvantaging our firms with higher prices, we lose market share in home markets, Canada, and away markets, the US. US producers fill the gap, but they emit more. And what happens is we're worried about emission leakage and production leakage. So the idea being that, you know, CO2 is a global pollutant and, you know, there's no location specific sort of impact. It's just global. So if emissions rise somewhere else because we're pricing our emissions here, we've just lost jobs and investment and we haven't necessarily reduced emissions. So that's why these programs exist, and they give sort of special exemptions for the facilities. I like to think of it as sort of the carbon action rebate that most Canadians get from the federal government, at least if you're, you know, sitting somewhere that's, some provincial programs don't give money back. British Columbia reduced taxes, so people don't, personal income taxes, don't see that reduction in income tax. But generally, like in Alberta, Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, people get a check back from the government or a tax reduction on our income taxes. And it's the same sort of idea. It's a little different, but the idea is that I want you to pay the price on pollution when you have the pump in your hand, but I'm going to give you the money back in your wallet that's unrelated to how much fuel you use. So basically, so your pocketbook, your household income is left more or less neutral, but you are thinking about the cost of gas and the carbon tax when you're pumping. So it's the same sort of idea with the large emitter programs.
That's interesting you brought that up, because I had actually heard you a few years ago on Planet Money back in the US, and you were being interviewed about Pigouvian taxes. And I think you were the person they came to describe that.
It's a bribe.
Yeah. I wonder if you could tell me more about I don't want to get too technical, but like how that's supposed to work.
Yeah. I mean, the Pigouvian tax, it's just basically the carbon price. You basically just want to raise the relative prices of a bad. So in this case, fossil fuels, and the carbon content of fossil fuels. And you basically want to, you want to send a price signal that it's more valuable and you need to manage it. I mean, that's really the basis of a Pigouvian tax. And because you transmit it broadly across all emitters, you send a consistent signal across everybody so that if you want to continue to pump gas, you can. If you want to buy an EV because you think it pays for you, then you buy an EV. And so the idea with these taxes is a broadly applied tax is more efficient. You can achieve your objectives at lower cost to the extent that more people see the same price signal. It's when you start sort of applying limited price signals to some, exemptions on emissions, like right now the federal system exempts, and most provincial systems exempts on-farm diesel fuel. So that's to help the farmers out. Well, so there's no price signal sitting there. They're not going to reduce their emissions because there's no price signal. So you've exempted them and you've diminished the efficiency and the effectiveness of the carbon price because you could have got cheaper emission reductions and more emission reductions. So that's how the Pigouvian tax basically works. The interesting bit is, what do you do with the revenue? And so from an efficiency perspective, we really don't care. We just care about that initial sort of, okay, is there a broad-based unified price signal? But then you generate all this cash, and it's basically a transfer in the system, and who gets that cash? And typically economists are agnostic on what you do with it. They would prefer income taxes to be reduced. So there's something called a dead weight loss. It's a great economics term. Or the marginal public cost of funds. Basically, that says when you tax people, you basically add drag on the economy and inefficiencies. And so the economists are like, well, you should tax offset, like British Columbia did. You should raise the carbon price, reduce personal and corporate income taxes. Why are we taxing labor? We want more labor. So we should reduce labor taxes so people work more, because that's what they want to do sometimes. So you know, and that economists like that because it deals with that tax inefficiency. But politicians don't care sometimes about efficiency, and they care about the bribe. And so the federal government basically threw money at everybody to accept the carbon price. And it worked. It totally worked. It went away as an issue, as a pocketbook issue, except for a small minority within the country. And then Quebec and most jurisdictions also choose to use the revenue to subsidize emission reducing technology. So that's another way to sort of deal with the, you know, so you reinforce the carbon signal by providing incentives for building retrofits, or you buy charging networks to deal with sort of, you know, to help with EV rollout. So yeah, how you use the revenue is a big political question, but the economist is less interested in that.
Just for our listeners who may not have heard the term Pigouvian tax, it's named after a British economist named Arthur Pigou. I think he was around in the early 20th century. Dave, you probably know if that's correct.
I think he was the first economics professor at Cambridge, is what I remember from...
Yeah, I knew him personally. I'm not old.
Yeah. Yeah.
I worked with him in the 20s. Jen Squeeze, I'm like... Jen Snooze or something, I don't know. And so if your listeners are interested, in fact, this is sort of first year environmental economics, master's level, Coase theorem instructed us, illustrated that basically if you enter into a bargain, you can have a win-win situation where you're trading basically pollution permits. So cap and trade systems are based on this guy Coase, and carbon tax systems are based on this guy Pigou, and basically there are two ways of sort of reducing emissions, and the theory underscores basically these two systems. But what's really interesting in the real world is that we actually have systems like this large emitter system that deals with prices and quantities, and they hybrid cap and trade and carbon prices. And in fact, the Alberta system right now is a hybrid system, has a limit on your emission intensity, the emissions per unit of production, that's going down in time. And then it has a price that we basically send that sends the price signal. And so it's called a hybrid system. So in reality, it's not an either or.
And Coase, for anyone who's wondering, because I was wondering and had to look it up, is spelled C-O-A-S-E.
Right, right.
Okay, so that's a fair bit that we've had to discuss, you know, just out of the proposal that's come out from the federal government. But I was wondering if we could take a step back and chat a bit about the Gen Squeeze side of things. So you've already hinted at a bit of this, Dave, so maybe we can jump a bit more into it. But could you tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've done over the years with Generation Squeeze?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, Gen Squeeze is great. I really enjoyed working with Gen Squeeze on basically, you know, we have a framework about how to assess the federal policies from a really comprehensive view. So in that, in the Gen Squeeze framework about on climate change, it's not just about reducing emissions, you know, like what we're talking about right now, but it's also about leaving no one behind. So just transition, you know, is a category in there where you want to look at the federal political platforms and see what the parties are saying on just transition. You want to see what the political parties are saying on impacts and adaptation. Some of the work I've been doing now on the costs of climate change in Canada, some of the sort of the economic costs are really stark as we start to roll out into the future in a changing climate. So the British Columbia storms of 2021 are getting more frequent and more intense and taking out more assets. So the Gen Squeeze framework says, okay, well, what are the platforms doing an adaptation? And I think what was really interesting about having this comprehensive framework that Gen Squeeze has is that it put a spotlight on the deficiencies in federal political thinking around adaptation, for example, around just transition. So you would have significant holes in political platforms that are just not, you know, congruent with the needs of sort of how to transition to a, you know, low carbon climate resilient economy. So yeah, I really enjoyed working with Gen Squeeze over the last two sort of federal elections, and I did some work in Ontario. And what's really stark is that the provincial platforms are incredibly weak compared to the federal platforms. The federal platforms are quite comprehensive. They're quite smart as a rule. They're ticking a lot of boxes, but the provincial platforms are absolutely deficient. And I think that's somewhere that Gen Squeeze needs to go and can go and really be helpful, you know, pulling or pushing along the provinces.
So Gen Squeeze has a very detailed climate plan that offers a set of solutions. And the goal of the plan is to hold average global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, while at the same time improving the lives and livelihoods of everyday Canadians. So I guess I'd want to ask to start off with, how is that possible? Like the fact that we can take substantive action on climate change while also ensuring that people's livelihoods improve. I mean, doesn't action on climate require sacrifices?
So there's a couple ways to think about this. I used to argue we needed the Timbit tax. So if we had implemented 20 years ago a 25 or 30 cent carbon tax and slowly increased it in time to get to $30 today, costs would have been minimal in terms of the transition. So delay is costly. So to the extent that we delay action and we don't send price signals now and set expectations to people, you know, when you're buying a new car or you're changing out your furnace or you're building a new oil sands facility, people need to believe that their carbon is going to be expensive and needs to be managed in time. And so what does this mean going out to the future? Well, net zero 10 years away, if I buy a car today, that car is going to be around 2035. Oil sands facilities, pipelines, large industrial facilities, even furnaces are 12 years along. So if we're buying natural gas furnaces today and we want to get aggressive on climate policy in 2028 because suddenly we realize we're really, really screwed, not just totally screwed, but that's another story. Wildfires in BC, floods, pestilence. So to the extent you don't change those decisions, it gets very expensive to knock out that productive capital and costs rise. So that's sort of how to think, that's the first way to think about it. The second way to think about it is that a lot of these technologies are just cheaper and they don't change sort of the level of service they give us. So think about LED light bulbs. LED light bulbs are now ubiquitous. 3-4 years ago, like, we just banned them. I think the incandescent bulbs, I'm going to say it was under the Harper government. It was 2013-14 they were banned. There's still some around a few years ago. Now LED light bulbs are everywhere. It hasn't really changed our lighting and it's reduced costs significantly. Electric vehicles are the same sort of thing. So there are savings to be had. And then of course there's the green transition around industrial policy and being able to win in a global environment, in a global competitiveness environment. And so we looked at, I call them the low carbon gazelles. So these are low carbon technologies and exports that we can look into Canada's trade data and say, okay, these categories are, you know, electric forklifts. This is, you know, biofuels, clean electricity exports, EVs, substances to make solar panels. So we identified sort of 150 of these categories, and we took a look at them from 2014 through 2019. They outperformed the broader sort of basket of trade by a factor of three. So they're growing at 10% year over year. Some of these things were growing at 80, 90% year over year relative to the general sort of trend in exports. So we talk about the green economy and we say, oh, well, in the future, it's going to be better off. But actually, when we look at what's going on now, we have all these sort of bright lights, these gazelles taking off. So green industrial policy isn't really, can't be really sneezed at, I think, or not sort of dismissed as it's a future thing. I think we have to do a better job of tracking that stuff now.
If I were to give you a magic wand, what do you think the most important things to change are about how Canada's approaching climate change? What three things would you do first?
So first, I would implement a really stringent, and you think I'm going to say carbon tax, but I'm not. I'm going to say a really stringent accountability framework for good governance. So I would like to see the Canadian Net Zero Accountability Act is an amazing step in the right direction. British Columbia has climate accountability legislation, as does Manitoba. I would like to see that all strengthened with much stronger reporting to Parliament or the provincial legislatures. I would like to see routine stock taking going on about are we on track or not. And that would involve the provinces and the federal government sitting down on a routine basis to take a look at the policies, to take a look at the data about whether we're on track, and then have independent oversight, like the Auditor General, the Commissioner of Environment and Sustainable Development, reporting to Parliament or the legislature about whether we're on track or not. You know, legislated targets. So if you look at what's going on globally right now, there's a lot of, and in fact, in British Columbia, I think West Coast Law has taken BC to court over inaction or being not compliant with their own legislation. I know Ontario EcoJustice has taken the Ontario government to court on behalf of Seven Youths. There's a great court action. I helped support it, which was really fun. But Seven Youths taking the provincial government to court over inaction. So that's what we get. So that's my one major magic wand, better climate accountability frameworks. Two is we go nuts on adaptation. We're chronically underspending on adaptation. We have to get really serious about it. It's not just the big storms and the floods. We have labor productivity. We have heat illness. We have smoke illness. We have, you know, the damages just go on and on and on across all segments of the economy. And so all governments have to get way more serious on that. And then I think, you know, the hard one is political consensus. If we could get rid of the polarization, which I think is the hardest one of all those. So those are my three. No carbon tax. We already have one. I don't need one. It's going to $170. We're good.
So there's a lot for our political leaders to do in your suggestions. I'm wondering, for the people who are listening to this podcast, what would you ask of them to think about and to think about doing?
Well, I can't tell you the youth, the Gen Squeeze crowd, to get more active. They're very active, and it's great. They're much more active than my generation, right? Again, I'm with Pigou in 1920. So, you know, I mean, marching in the streets and being politically active is a good thing. Just continue to do that. I think open your mind up a little bit to solutions, though. One of the things I find with carbon policy, it's such a complex issue on the policy and the technology and the politics, is that anytime somebody comes to you with, hey, I have the solution, here's the idea, think in your head, oh, no, you don't. You don't understand the problem at all because you're too simplistic on this. So I'm not advocating, oh, it's so complex, we can't do it, but just beware of people saying, oh, here's the solution, because there's lots of competing technologies for the same end use. So you think about long-haul trucking, hydrogen, electricity, biofuels, efficiency in vehicles. They're all competing. We don't know which one's going to win. So we have to be a little agnostic in our choices about incenting, you know, the winners to emerge, like not pick winners, for example. So, and you know, it's like, oh, well, offshore turbines are the solution. Well, yeah, they're part of the solution, but they're not the solution. So that's one of the things I like to think about, is if you think you know the answer in climate policy, pause and take stock, because chances are you might have it wrong. So open your minds a little bit to solutions. Would be the other one.
so much for tuning in to Gin Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. In finishing up this episode, we want to highlight the fact that Gin Squeeze was actually involved in the Supreme Court case that Dave mentioned, affirming the federal government's right to price pollution.
That's right. From 2019 to 2021, Gin Squeeze led a coalition of six organizations that intervened in court cases about pricing pollution, first in Ontario and Saskatchewan, and then at the level of the Supreme Court.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. If you haven't yet subscribed, please make sure you do so.
Please also consider reviewing the podcast on Apple.
Until next time.
Bye.